Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mosen, and on Main Menu this week, free yourself from the PC and hear internet radio and much more on any FM radio in the house. We play a couple of great accessible computer games and talk to their author. KnowUK is a very powerful web-based research tool. We put it through its paces and discuss its many features. We unravel some of the mysteries of the Windows registry, look at an easy way to put your MP3 files on regular audio CD if you have a CD writer, and we have another look at Linux. All this coming up over the next 2 hours on ACB Radio Mainstream's Main Menu. It wasn't that long ago that hearing radio on the internet was a gimmick, a bit of a novelty. Nowadays, there's a lot of outstanding content available via the internet, and the quality in some cases can even be better than FM radio, depending on your internet connection and the equipment of the webcaster. But it's no fun having to sit in front of your computer all day just to hear your favourite radio station. So a number of companies are now starting to come out with a package that allows you to transmit audio so that whatever comes out of your PC can be heard on any FM radio in your house. The very first company to come out with such a product, designed specifically for internet radio, was In-House Radio Networks. It just so happens that Mike Calvo of In-House Radio Networks is blind. So while the radio webcaster is a mass market product, they're very conscious of accessibility. So on the line with me now is Mike Calvo of In-House Radio Networks. Mike, welcome to Main Menu. First of all, tell us a little bit about what the radio webcaster actually is.
The radio webcaster is a transmitter that connects to the back of your PC. It allows you to broadcast any audio from your PC to any FM radio. The product also comes with a remote control unit that communicates with the computer via a little connector that goes connected to your serial port and allows you to change radio stations that are pre-programmed into a piece of software that we provide you. And as you push buttons on the remote control, the unit talks to you through your radio and explains, you know, and tells you that you're going channel up, channel down, you're turning your volume up, you're turning your volume down if you're scanning. That's pretty much what it does. It transmits any audio. It doesn't matter if it's brought up by our software or not. Just anything that comes out through your speakers can basically be radio webcasted.
So, for instance, you could be listening to a book that you were reading with OpenBook or Cursor 1000 if you had software speech, and just sort of take your FM radio that's beside the bed and listen to it.
Sure. I've seen some pretty innovative users of the radio webcaster. It's interesting, Jonathan, because we started as, I'm blind myself, as you know, but the product started in the mainstream, if you will. And when the blind community heard about it, they embraced it quite a bit, so much so that we are leaning more in the direction of becoming a blind, quote-unquote, blind product. Where we are paying more and more attention to our blind customers. I've seen some people using the radio webcaster with wireless keyboards, so they can take this keyboard, you know, 100, 200 feet away from the computer with their FM radio, and all of a sudden now they've got, you know, they've got a computer that they can use all over the house.
Yeah, it's like kind of a laptop, really, isn't it, on a small scale?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I've seen some discussions on some of the lists about that. People are talking about this new, I guess, a Logitech keyboard, and I've gotten a bunch of tech support questions about that. And we're always interested in hearing stories like that about what people are doing with the product, because it's an awesome product. I don't put the thing down myself, and I've had one for almost 2 years now.
So how far away can you go from the transmitter before the signal starts to break up a little bit in the stereo and that kind of thing?
Well, the stereo signal, I found that it depends on a couple of things. The stereo signal stays pretty strong up to about 150 feet, 200 feet you know, in each direction. I've tested it in a home as large as 3,900 square feet, and it's worked fine. And I'm talking about like out in the backyard by the pool and that kind of thing. I've gotten reports in tech support that people can get in their car and drive a block away and hear the thing. So it really depends on your region. It depends on if you're in a metropolitan area. It depends on the weather conditions. I mean, you know how radio signals are.
And is it legal? I mean, you're working with an FCC specs there, I guess.
Yeah, the product is compliant with Part 15 of the FCC code here in the United States. It has a removable coaxial antenna that connects. It's basically a piece of cable that connects to the unit that makes the unit the length of the antenna makes the unit stronger or weaker in the antenna configuration. And I've heard of people outside of the United States using rabbit ears and things of that nature just to make it reach all the further. And there are other places that you can buy retransmitters, if you will, that'll take this thing up to a watt if you want it.
Yes. What about frequency response in terms of the fidelity? Is it comparable to listening to a regular FM radio station?
It can be. It all depends on how much time the user wants to spend tweaking his signal. As you know, the FM band is a very narrow band frequency-wise. You've got about 32K that you can get, which is lower than a CD. And the way that the big radio stations do it is they use a product called an OptiMod.
They use it to excess. I mean, some of them just totally process their signals to heck. Anyway.
Isn't it terrible? Yeah, they do squeeze it down real bad. But what the OptiMod does is it's an equalizer that takes each harmonic band and squeezes it down to fit into that 32K band, and that's how your radio sounds so punchy and so beautiful, as compared to when you're sending something from your sound card at 44.1K. And you're sending it straight into the radio. The radio's kind of saying, huh? And you have to really play with it to get the highs and the bass exactly right, either by using a parametric EQ or EQing the signal in. Now, that's not saying that it doesn't sound good out of the box. What I'm saying is that to get it to sound comparable to a commercial FM broadcast, it is possible to get it darn close. I mean, I would never want to say that you can get a $150 item to sound like a, you know, several hundred thousand dollar radio station, but it can sound pretty good. And you know, the transmitter doesn't create a bunch of background noise like some of these transmitters that you pick up in different places on the net and whatnot. Like the kits, our product is not like, we don't have a bunch of guys sitting in a back room building a bunch of kits and sending out a board or whatever. I've heard of some transmitters that are just a little circuit board that they send you that you hook in wires to. You know, our product is packaged. It's got a knob on the front that you turn to tune it. It's got the knob has a button on the side of it that's a high-low button, so you can select what part of the FM band you're going to be broadcasting on. So it's a very consumer-friendly device and very forgiving if you overdrive it. It doesn't, you know, you there. Basically, if the harder you drive it, the less range it transmits. So once you get everything balanced and your highs right and your mids right and your lows right, it's going to give you a very, very nice signal that's going to sound great. Again, it's not going to be CD quality, but it will certainly be very acceptable.
So you've got access through this to the full FM spectrum from 88 to 108?
Sure. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we decided to do early on, we were going to go with a digital tuner. And first of all, when we realized that it was going to price the unit up near $300, because just the chip for that digital tuner is almost $90, then we realized we'd have to get one for the United States and one for Europe. The whole thing about going analog, we use analog tuning and we don't have that problem. You can use the unit in the United States or in Europe with no problem. It goes to the even and odd numbers.
How stable is the transmitter in terms of keeping the frequency you tuned it to?
That depends totally on your weather conditions. Obviously, the more stable your weather conditions are, the more stable the signal will be. I happen to be living in sunny Miami, Florida, where it's about the same temperature every day of the year, pretty much. So I probably tune my transmitter once a year, twice a year, and I've been running the same transmitter for 2 years. But I have talked to some folks that they have to tune it every, you know, every 100 days, every 45 days, every 60 days, but it certainly isn't, you know, you're listening to something and all of a sudden it's going to drift off and you're going to find it halfway down the dial.
So it would be very fractional alterations if there were going to be any.
Oh, sure, yeah. Every once in a while you just go over there and tweak it.
Let's move on to the remote control and tell us a bit about that. You mentioned in the website that I just had a look at that you've got around about 3,000 radio stations on that thing. Is that still the number?
Yes, it is. Right now we're working on getting permission from a lot of them. We've got about 1,400 and some odd stations that we've verified, and we've gotten their formats down and everything else. We're going through a bit of a transition right now with the database because we are Windows Media based right now. However, our developers are at the moment working on what has become in the industry to be known as an agnostic decoder. It doesn't care Windows Media, Real Audio, or what. The way that some software programs get around this is by just, if you have the players installed, they launch the player. We can't do that because of the way that the radio webcaster works when it talks. Not to mention that a lot of those, Real Audio strictly prohibits you to use Windows Media when you include them in a, you know, in a product. So what a lot of these people have gotten to do is they're basically a database application that just calls up a database, types in a URL, and then launches the player. We ship the controls with the unit because our remote control unit actually works the controls in the software. And as you type in numbers on the remote control, it goes to a database, looks up information, and then actually uses the built-in control, not the control that you have in your computer already when you first start.
Real Audio actually expressly will not allow you to have a product that does Windows Media and Real at the same time?
Oh, sure. Real Audio is the only one, as a matter of fact. Anything you see out there that, even this Real Audio plugin for Winamp, is very interesting. I don't know how they got to do that. I would imagine, I don't believe that was developed by Nullsoft.
No, and all it's doing is using the ActiveX control that Real has installed. But what about the Highwire tuner, which I think offers both?
I don't know how they're doing that. We have tried contacting Highwire in the past. I know how our guys are doing it is they're playing with the ActiveX controls as well. And see, the way that Real gets around it is Real says, if you want our tech support and our information on how to use our ActiveX control to its most effectiveness, then you need to sign a license agreement that says that you're not going to put anything else under your roof with us. But there's enough information out there to those who want to know about the ActiveX controls for Real Audio to where everybody kind of thumbs their nose at Real Audio and says, to heck with you, we're going to use it anyway. And they can't do anything about it. They can't tell you don't use it. Because if they didn't want you to use it, then they shouldn't include the ActiveX control in the software. You know.
So how long do you think it will be before you start including other formats besides Windows Media?
Right now we are in a transitionary period with funding with several different issues. We promised our users 60 days, and unfortunately we're not going to make that. It may be another 45 to 60 days from now. Now, we've been saying 60 days since January, and we do have it in a demo format that we can demo it, we can show it that it works, but it certainly, the biggest part of software, the hardest part of software is not getting it to do what it does, it's getting it to do what it does all the time, under every possible scenario. Debugging is a huge, that takes longer to debug than it does to write. And that's where we're at, and due to financial reasons, funding and things of that nature, we have had to split our time up between raising funds, focusing on marketing and development. So we're taking care of those issues right now. We're working on a very interesting partnership that I'm not able to go into right now, but it is with a huge company that will benefit Radio Webcaster in many ways. As I said at the beginning of this, we are looking to focus more and more on the blind community. When you've got Kerbango out there, who's these other people? Sonic Box, which is a direct copy, by the way, of our product. And I challenge them to say it's not.
Can you do anything about that? I mean, is what you've done patented in any way?
Yes, it is patented. Patent is pending right now. And I assume with discussions with our attorneys and stuff that we will cross that bridge when we get to it. But yes, we filed disclosure documents with the United States government years ago. We were in business prior to Sonic Box. Our website was brought on the net prior to theirs, and we, up to this point, are the only product of its kind that is truly on the market and selling. And, you know, we've been reviewed on ZDTV, we've been reviewed in CNN, we've been reviewed in PC Magazine, we've enjoyed several, I mean, you can type Radio Webcaster into any search engine and find more information than I could possibly speak about on this program.
Now, it is important to emphasize that our discussion about the remote and the stations that's accessible, of course, you can still use your regular Internet Explorer or your Internet player and put anything that you want to listen to, such as ACB Radio, which is not there at the moment because of the format issues. You can put all of that through the Radio Webcaster because it simply broadcasts whatever's coming out your sound card.
Right, and we will be releasing, our next release will definitely have the ability. Right now, the unit comes with the database, and if you like something from the big database, you hit a button on the remote control, and it stores it in your favorites. In the next revision, which should be released in the next 30 days, we will be providing the ability to not only edit your data, you know, your favorite entries, but go ahead and add your own URLs. And we've had so many phone calls into Microsoft and discussions with the Icecast people and with the Shoutcast people, and nobody can figure out, even Microsoft can't figure out how to make this darn thing work all the time. You know, you can pull up a Shoutcast stream with Windows Media, but you can't do it all the time, and sometimes it'll sit there and buffer and buffer and buffer and
yeah.
buffer and buffer, and about 20 minutes later, you'll hear it.
I noticed that Sonic Box allows you to download its tuner now, separate from its transmitter, which I don't think is even out there yet. Can you download the Radio Webcaster tuner?
This is one of the areas where, yes, you can. Now, can you use it? That's an entirely different issue. The Radio Webcaster software can be used by a sighted person at this time, but not by a blind person, simply because when we developed the Radio Webcaster software, it was never meant to be a standalone product. The only reason that the software is there is to explain to the sighted user, hey, this is how it works. Because what happens is when you bring the software up, a picture of the remote control comes up It's an actual JPEG of the remote control that comes up with hot zones under it. And as the software sees your mouse go over a certain position and it receives a drill down on that particular area of this, of the picture, it then performs the same action that the remote control would do. And that's impossible. I've tried writing hotkeys for it with JAWS. I can't do it. So the answer in short is, yes, it's available. No, it's not accessible yet. We are working with some folks to do a skin that will have standard Windows controls under it, and that may just make the next release.
And how much does the product cost? Can you get it in different bundles? For example, people who've already got a cordless keyboard, can they just buy the transmitter without the remote, or does it come as one package?
No, you can get the Radio Webcaster in a couple of different flavors. You can get the software and the remote only for $49.95. You can get the transmitter only for $99, or you can get the whole bundle for $149. The other thing that's real neat, Jonathan, that I really haven't mentioned here is that we are going to be having the ability to record off the net. You'll be able to tell it, for example, either record on the fly, or you'll be able to tell it, I got a program that comes up every week at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is the URL. You know, record it. And what it'll do is it'll record it, convert it to an MP3, and then you can manipulate that MP3 any way you want. You can download it to your Rio, or you can listen to it, or you can archive it, or burn it onto a CDR, or whatever you want to do.
And when will that be available? Is that in the next release?
It will be coming up very shortly. That will probably be coming out with the agnostic decoder features. We've got, as a matter of fact, that's very far along, and that's working in our labs. It just needs to be incorporated into the current build.
Any other exciting features you can tell us about?
Right now we're the writer who wrote Radio Webcaster, my partner's name is Andy Martinez. He wrote a package that's called MicroBroad. MicroBroad is for microbroadcasters. It's an entire microbroadcast radio station package. And he has offered to incorporate a majority of its features into Radio Webcaster. And we are going to be releasing that it's going to be an add-on that will be called the Radio Webcaster Music Server. And what that will allow you to do is to literally put together your own in-house radio network, i.e. that's the name for the company, In-House Radio Networks. But what you'll be able to do is you'll be able to tell this thing, this is my CD, my MP3 collection, and it will play them. It can play liners, it can play commercials, it can do the crossfades. It'll do a random play of everything in your library, or you can schedule it. It even has scheduling features where you can pull up a 24 hour list and schedule. I mean, it's very, very, very radio station like. So you can be it'll work the whole radio station at the click of a mouse, or you can program it. It also comes with a built-in CD ripper that will rip the stuff and convert them to MP3. It'll go to the CDDB, pull down all the information, and write in the tags on the MP3. And that should be out right along with everything else. Again, like I said, we've been going through a lot of internal changes, seeking after funding and things like that. And last week was a very scary week for all .com companies due to the whole market thing that was going on here in the U.S.
Indeed. But you still feel like you're on track for these new features and for the growth of the company?
Oh, yes. We're working on... See, the biggest problem that Radio Webcaster has right now as a company is that the technology is moving very quickly. And what plans we laid 2 months ago, by the time we bring them to fruition, the plans have changed because the market, it'll just run you down. It runs you down. So what sounded like an innovative new idea 2 months ago is kind of old already. And that's the biggest problem that we have, is trying to predict this market and what's going to be hot, you know, 3 months from now, 6 months from now. We figured when we released the product in July that we were going to put it out and these things were just going to fly off the shelves. And to be quite honest with you, they sold pretty well, but we're starting to pick up sales now, you know, almost a year later. You know, so it's a very, you know, we don't want to give the people too much, to where by the time that it becomes needed, we've been there, we've done that, and people are looking at us saying, well, what are you going to do now? You know, I had somebody asking me the other day, he says, well, you know, besides the fact that you can, you know, change the stations from anywhere in the house, I mean, does it do anything else? It's like, what do you mean, buddy? That's a real big deal right there. You know, there's not another product on the market that can do that. You know, but, you know, consumers, we've gotten real spoiled, so we're trying to keep up, we're trying to make sure that we keep the bell, we don't want to put 50 bells and whistles that don't work right. Our programmer is very thorough, and he will not release any code before it's time. So we're hoping that we meet the schedules. We've also got some things, like I said, with this new partner that we're working with. One of the things that is semi-public knowledge is there will be a radio reading service for the blind, an online radio reading service for the blind, probably being released by the end of this year, if not early 2001. And it will be several different radio reading services combined on one server. And one of the things that we are attempting to do is work with these people to try and get a radio webcaster type device into the hands of blind people worldwide for free. It would be sponsored, obviously it would be advertised driven, which wouldn't be a problem to me, actually. I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with hearing an advertisement about how I can get stuff delivered to my front door. You know, I don't hear enough of that as it is.
And how can people find out more about the radio webcaster and perhaps look at purchasing the product?
Well, they can visit us online at www.radiowebcaster.com. We post information there. They can also become members of our mailing list. We try and keep traffic there down to a minimum. It is an e-groups list, and it consists of users and people who want to buy the product. We encourage people who want to buy the product to go on the mailing list, look through the archives, look at what the users have said. We don't erase any messages. We don't erase positive or derogatory comments from our users. We're very honest with people. We've gone through our growing pains, and we still do go through them now. But you can see on our emailing list where people have been irate about an issue, and that they've come back later and said, you know, the company really took care of us, and you know, we have a very open door policy with our users. I'm always available, either by email or whatever. I don't know if you've ever looked at the clock, but you've written me at some pretty weird times of the day, and I'm right there. You know, we don't believe in weekends. We don't believe it's 5 o'clock. We're shutting the door. We're very user oriented, and especially for the blind user. We've run into problems where people have needed to configure their systems, and we'll walk them through it. I hate when I call a software company and they blame it on someone else and say, well, you're going to have to call them to fix it. If it's within our ability to help a user get the system working, then we do. And likewise, to get information out, emails get answered very quickly. If there's any information, if anybody wants to submit a station that they'd like to see on the software, you know, we would be very happy to incorporate it into the next release.
From In-House Radio Networks, that's Mike Calvo talking about their product, the Radio Webcaster.
on ACB Radio's main menu. This is DJ C at acbradio.org with news and views you can use. On today's main menu, this is Don Coco from Sacramento, California, and I'd like to take time today to talk about applications, why they misbehave, and ways that you can minimize or prevent applications from misbehaving or make corrections. Now, the first thing you need to understand is applications misbehave for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's conflicts in your machine with other DLL files, and sometimes the applications just misbehave because they're poorly written, they're poorly designed. Sometimes when an application misbehaves, there are ways of fixing it, and the first thing I would check if an application is misbehaving for you, the first thing I would do is go to the main folder that the application is in, like C program files Winamp, for example. Not that I'm picking on Winamp, by the way, I'm not, but we'll just use that as an example here. Go to Winamp, and you will find in the folder, and this is not always the rule either, but you will find in the folder, in the case of Winamp, a configuration file. It can be either a .ini file or a .cfg file. If your application is misbehaving, sometimes you can delete the .ini file or the .cfg file, and then restart the application, which will cause it to draw a brand new .ini or .cfg file. Now, you'll probably come up with, like, the opening screen. That's the initial setup screen if you do that, and you'd have to re-put in your settings, but that's easy enough to do. And sometimes that will fix problems when applications are performing illegal operations. It doesn't always fix problems this way, but it's at least possible. So that's the thing I would check first. Now, if that fails, you can always try uninstalling the application and reinstalling the application. Sometimes that will correct the problem. But not always. It may and it may not. I'll give you an example of one of the oddest situations I've run into in a long, long time. Now, I'm always working on my machine to keep it, or try to keep it running in top shape. I don't think there's any way to keep these machines running really, really efficiently because the way Windows is designed, there's always problems. There's so many bugs in this Windows anyway. It's unfortunate, it really is, but that's just the nature of the business, I guess. And the only thing you can do to keep your machine running efficiently is to make sure you know what software you've installed and make sure you know what your software is doing at all times. Now, there are registry cleaner programs that you can download. There are some good ones. Norton Utilities, I'm told, has a great suite of utilities, such as CrashProof and some of the other apps that help keep your registry in top shape. I go by a very fine program called Fixit Utilities. It's put out by a company called Megenix, megenix.com. Is the program I happen to use. I like it very much. It's called Fixit, and it keeps the registry running pretty good. But there are times when you may need to go into your registry to actually delete or hand-delete keys. And I'm going to teach you how to do that today. So the first thing we want to do is we want to type the Start menu, and then we want to type Run. And we're going to type that, and we're going to come up on the, and we're going to tell it that we want to go to the registry, so we come up on the dialog box for Run, and we type REGEDIT, and we hit the return, and we're going to come up with the registry editor, and we're now at the registry editor, and the first key that's at the top is my computer, because obviously that's the top of the tree. Now, a registry editor is set up in a tree view. So you have the tree view, and then you have the list view. If you tap over once, you have the list view. So you have the tree view, and you have the list view. Now, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to go to the... We're already in the registry. Now, the first thing I want to teach you is how to save a previous registry. So if your machine's running perfectly right now, you might want to save a registry on zip disk or on a floppy disk is fine, just so you have a backup copy. That way, if later on you were to make a mistake and delete keys, you could probably get into safe mode and you could restore the previous registry. So if your machine's not booting up properly, as long as you have a copy, you're okay. And the way we do this, we're at my computer, as I said, which is the top region. So what we want to do is we want to press the Alt key, and it says Registry, and you pull the menu down with the bottom arrow key, the down arrow key, and it says Import Registry, that's the first one, and Export Registry, that's the second one. So we're going to hit the return on Export Registry. And what are we going to call it? We'll call it, REG1. And it's saved as a .reg file, which means when you click on that file later on or open it, it's going to actually import or offer to import those settings into the registry, and you just tell it yes, and it will do it. So we're going to save it. Let's see where I'm. Make sure I know where I'm saving it. We're saving it to. We're going to save it as C:\Rec1 or REG1, and we're going to tell it save. It now writes. It's writing the whole registry. It takes a few seconds to do it, and it's there. And now it's available to me. It's perfectly saved, and that way if I delete all kinds of keys, my machine won't boot. I can go to either DOS or, I guess safe mode. You wouldn't want to go directly to DOS and open it there because that won't import it. You have to go to safe mode and then to the registry, and then what you can do is you can tell it import the registry, locate REG1, or you can also go to the file itself and just hit the return on it, and it will offer to import the registry. So this is how we save a registry. Now, to find an item in the registry, what we want to do is we want to type the name in the registry, and what we're going to do is we're going to type F3 for find. And what are we going to look for? We're going to look for DELTATHREE, Delta 3 is what we're going to look for, and we're going to hit the return, and it's going to take off and go looking for Delta 3. And once it finds a match, it will tell me that it's found a match. Okay, now we have found an item in the registry that is in tree view. In docspec.ru8 is what the tree view shows. Now, there are other entries. We'll tab over. And it's Delta 3. It's the 10th item out of 12 items. And you only want to delete the Delta 3 item here. Don't delete other items in this list box, because if you do that, you will mess up your registry where Java is concerned and other things. But this Delta 3 entry, we can delete. We don't want it. We don't need it. We don't care about it. So we press the delete key. And we get a bong. And do I want to delete the key? Yes, I do. I type Y. And then I type F3 again, and it will go looking for the next occurrence of Delta 3. It's now looking again. And we have session Delta 3. And this is an FTP entry. According to the tree view, it's in FTP. Because everything you do with the machine gets recorded in the registry. The registries are huge. They just, you know, they store everything. You know, every little thing you do, pretty much. Now, this is an FTP entry. We don't need to worry about it, so we'll just tell it to find the next occurrence. And this is site Delta 3, it shows. And this is most recent sites that I visited. I visited the FTP site. And I don't want to delete that. I don't need to delete that one. So I ask it to look again. You just keep pressing F3 for the different entries that you're looking for. And when you find the occurrences you want to delete. You just press the delete key on them, and that will delete them. I would like to caution you again, however, you want to handle the registry with some care, but you certainly can edit the registry. It's not that you can't do it. Anybody can do it if you're careful. And I stress that. Please don't write me hate mail, by the way, if you screw up your registry. But if you follow my steps, you should have no real problem editing the registry. Once everything is done, it will say no more occurrences, and it will tell you okay, and you can just close the registry at that point, and you should be fine if everything is gone properly. If you're unsure, if you've made a mistake, restart your machine. If it doesn't come up properly, well, that's why we had you back up the registry. So there you go on today's program on the main menu, some tips to help you keep your machine running properly. Well, that's it for this time around. So on behalf of the main menu, this is DJC at acbradio.org, thanking you for listening. See you next week.
In many parts of the world, it's a holiday weekend as we celebrate Easter, and it's a time for us to take a bit of time out and maybe do a few things that we wouldn't normally do. Actually, in this part of the world, in New Zealand, where I am, it's a very long weekend because we have Easter backing right onto another of our holidays, Anzac Day. So people here have 5 days off. And that's a good excuse to think about taking time out to play some computer games and unwinding. And I thought, well, let's do a bit of a feature on Main Menu about one of the game developers for the blind, and we'll try and cover other ones in future editions of Main Menu. So I thought let's take a look at some of the games produced by Robert Betts, whose site is at www.gamesfortheblind.com. I've got to have a chat to Robert shortly. He hasn't been in this business for too long, and yet he's been quite prolific in terms of his output. We've got time to look at a couple of his games in brief before we have a chat to him. One of them is the Battleships game, which was one of the first ones that he developed. So let's bring that up now. I'm at the computer.
Windows Update.
And
Accessible Games Submenu.
I'm using JFW with the DeckTalk Access 32 for this demonstration. So we're at the Programs menu here, and it's come right up on Accessible Games, which is where Robert puts his games.
Accessible Games. Battleship Help. Battleship.
Okay, so here we are with the Battleship game. It even comes with a nice help file. These games do run under Windows, and they do require at this stage JFW. So let's push enter to go into the Battleship game, and we'll show you what it's all about here.
Start button.
Initiating startup sequence.
Accessible Battleship dialogue. Press F1 for help. Press F2 for status. It is your turn, and you are located in 1.
Now, the help file in this game, as they are in all of Robert's games, is actually very comprehensive. I'm in a Battleships game now, and if you're familiar with this game of Battleships, you'll know that you have a grid, and it has coordinates A1 through to I9 in this case, and you imagine that you've got a board with little squares. You can use the right arrow key to move along a line and the up arrow key to move to the next line. The one weakness, I think, of this game is it doesn't have a mode where you can actually program your own ships for the computers to hit, but maybe that'll come in a subsequent version. So I've now got to try and find out where one of the computer's ships are. I will just move up here.
B3.
Oh, okay, I've got to hit the down arrow to go down the grid, okay.
C3.
Let's try C3. I hit enter.
C3 was a miss. M, it is my turn targeting G6. G6 was a miss.
No.
It is your turn and you are located at C3.
You notice that it said M. That's because it's actually filled in the square for me, so if I arrow away and come back to it...
C4.
I come back to C3.
C3 miss.
So, it's good because it remembers what you've already tried and what you know doesn't work. So let's move right up to, say, I9.
I9.
Okay, I9.
I9 was a miss. M, It is my turn targeting D2. D2 was a miss. It is your turn and you are located at I-9.
Now what I'm doing is just using the arrow keys up and down, left and right to highlight the square I think that the computer might have a ship, and then hitting enter. So let's be optimistic. If I just push the home key to go to the beginning of this row,
I-1.
I'm on I-1, which is certainly what I hope to do. So let's hit enter for I-1.
I-1 was a miss. M, it is my turn targeting a 3. The 3 was a miss.
Well, I'm actually trying to...
It is your turn and you are located at I-1.
Yeah, okay, I'm actually trying to play this to the point that you actually hear what happens when someone hits something. So let's see, let's...
H1.
Try H1.
H1 was a miss. M, it is my turn targeting Z2. Z2 was a miss. It is your turn and you are located at H1.
Alright.
F1.
Let's go sort of roughly to the middle of the board.
E1.
Try about F...
F6.
F...
F5. F5 was a hit on my aircraft carrier. Hey, it is my turn targeting T5.
Oh, he got me! Rude.
D9 was a hit on your aircraft carrier.
Okay, now...
Your turn and you are located at F5.
We're at F5, and I've hit his aircraft carrier, which is the largest ship. I think from memory it's about 5 or 6 squares worth. Now, he could have that going across in either direction, or he could have it going vertically, and I've got to try and work that out. So let's...
F6.
Go under the right and try F6.
F6 was a miss.
Okay.
M, it is my turn targeting C9. C9 was a miss.
Good.
It is your turn and you are located at F6.
He's no brighter than I am. Why do I think this computer's a he when I'm playing a game with it?
F4.
Bad thing there. There we go. Try F4.
F4 was a miss.
Okay, so
M,
it's not going
my turn
across
targeting
the grid. No, the computer's trying E9. And it's got the neck now. There goes another bit of my aircraft carrier.
E9 was a hit on your aircraft carrier. It is your turn and you are located at F4.
Oh, yes, I suppose I better...
F5 hit aircraft carrier. E5.
Okay, let's try E5. Okay.
E5 was a hit on my aircraft carrier.
So it's going vertically.
It is my turn targeting F9. F9 was a hit on your aircraft carrier. It is your turn and you are located at D5.
Okay, now let's,
D5.
Try D5. And we got another one.
D5 was a hit on my aircraft carrier. Hey, it is my turn targeting D9. G9 was a hit on your aircraft carrier. It is your turn and you are... C5. C5 was a miss.
Okay,
M,
so we know exactly where we're going now.
H9.
I think so does this computer, actually.
I sank your aircraft carrier.
Okay, so that's how it works, and the idea is that you've got to destroy all the computer's battleships before the computer destroys yours, and that's how it goes. It's a fun game, and it's extremely well done with, at least with JFW, it's extremely accessible, and there is help. For instance, I can hit the F2 key for status as well.
You have sank 0 of my ships. I have sank 1 of your ships. Your aircraft carrier.
And it tells me exactly what the state of play is, which at this stage isn't terribly optimistic, but if we were to keep playing this game, of course, I know exactly where the aircraft carrier is now, and I would soon catch up, and so the battle would continue. So that's how the battleships game works. Let's just exit this one.
Accessible battleship dialogue. Accessible battleship dialogue. There is a game in progress. Are you sure you want to exit the program?
Yes,
sir. Initiating shutdown sequence.
Accessible battleship dialogue. Untitled Star Cool Edit.
Okay, now we're back in Cool Editor, which I'm using to record this particular part of the thing, simply because SoundForge takes up too many CPU resources, really, for me to do everything on the same computer. Okay, so now we will go back into the Programs menu and...
Windows Up, Accessible Games submenu.
Go into Accessible
Programs.
Games.
Accessible Games, Battleship, Blackjack Help, Blackjack.
And let's go to the casino!
Start... Accessible, press F2 for help. Accessible blackjack dialogue. Stakes dialogue. Stakes list box. $1,000.
Okay, so we're right into it here. We're playing blackjack. It's asking me my stakes, which is essentially the total amount of money that I have to play with. Well, being the impoverished person that I am...
$2,000.
Oh, no, we're going the wrong way.
Top.
Oh, don't need, oh, okay. $1,000 is the least I can bet, so we better stick with that. I'll hit enter.
Your bet dialogue. Bet amount list box. $100.
I think I'll bet $100, I think. So I'm just gonna hit enter.
Shuffling cards.
Accessible blackjack dot. Player. List box. 10 of clubs.
Now what I'm in here is a list box which shows me the cards that the dealer has given me so far, and obviously in this particular demonstration we can't go too much into the rules of blackjack, but they are there. There's a help file and it does take you through not only the basics of blackjack but also things like how to double down and different stuff like that, so it's a very well written help file. Here we have the 10 of clubs, very nice.
9 of diamonds.
And that's a good hand, 9 of diamonds, and
bottom.
Of course, that's the end. Now, I need to refresh my memory as to what to do at this point to give the stay command. So, there is an F2 command. F1 will take me into the full help topics book. F2 will give me a kind of a context-sensitive help.
This is the player list box which contains your cards. Use the up and down arrow keys to read your cards one at a time. Press page up to hit or receive another card. Press page down to stay, meaning you will keep the cards you currently have. Press the left arrow of a double down. Press the right arrow of a split pairs. Press the delete key to make an insurance bet. Press F3 for current stakes amount. Press the home key to read all of your cards. Press the end key to read the dealer's card. Remember that the dealer has one card showing and the other card face down, so only one card is visible.
So a lot of commands there, but it's always at your fingertips with F2. Let's stay in this case, so I'm going to hit the page down key and see what happens.
The player stays. The dealer has a king of clubs and a 4 of diamonds.
Good.
The dealer hits. The dealer drew the 5 of clubs.
Oh.
The dealer stays. Accessible, but this game was a draw. You and the dealer both have 19. You do not lose any money. Your bet will return to your stakes.
Don't win any either, though.
Your cards, 10 of clubs, 9 of diamonds. Dealer's cards, king of clubs, 4 of diamonds, 5 of clubs.
Well... that's pretty dull. So let's try again and have some sort of definitive answer here. I'm going to hit enter.
Player. Accessible blackjack dialogue. List box. 5 of hearts.
So it's accepted my existing bet.
Queen of hearts.
And that's a bit of a yucky hand, really, because I've got 15. And I am tempted to take a risk and take another card.
King of spades.
All right, you. Now with a cash.
Accessible, you drew the king of spades, comma, which puts you over 21. You lose $100, which is the amount of your bet. Your cards, 5 of hearts, queen of hearts, king of spades, your total is 25.
Yes, quite right. Well, that's accessible blackjack, and we could go on for some time playing that, and I probably will. I'll keep this window open on my computer and come back to it after I've finished talking to you here on Main Menu. And before I get totally engrossed in this game, let me stop and have a chat to Robert Betts, who's on the phone now. He has created these JFW-compatible games, which you can find at www.gamesfortheblind.com. Robert, it's good stuff. Really is. Can you tell me how you got into making these games?
I've enjoyed computers ever since the 70s and played with them throughout the years. And then I lost my eyesight in 1986 from retinitis pigmentosa. And, instead of it being a bad thing, it allowed me to leave my job and return to college and pursue computers as a career, though.
And did the advent of Windows have any impact on the ability that you had to program? Did you have to go back and do some more work to learn how to do all the stuff in Windows?
Oh, yes. It was a great difficulty for me going from a DOS programmer into Windows. It was very difficult, but I had a very good friend, Barry Hamilton, that really helped me through the process. He was sighted, and he really helped me make the transition into Windows. And now I firmly believe that Windows is much better than DOS ever was.
Did you write games in DOS, or is this just something you've done recently?
I had three programs on the market in DOS. I wrote a screen reader for DOS that was named Sam, that was mostly sold locally in South Florida. And then I had a chess game that was playable between people over the modem, and a scientific calculator.
And so the whole area of writing games is something that's quite new to you. What made you decide to get into games in particular?
Mostly the mailing list. Monitoring the JFW mailing lists and the PC audio list that you are the moderator of, I noticed that people were always asking, where are the accessible games? Where can we find games? And I started searching myself and didn't come up with very many, so it's like, well, this would be a good area to start with.
So what was the first one that you put together?
Accessible Yahtzee was actually the first one that I put together. That one still doesn't have sound effects. I get a lot of email asking me for that. I need to go back and work on it and put some sound effects in it. I've noticed that most people really want the sound effect. That's what they want.
What's the process involved in putting a game like that together? For example, you'd need to know the rules really well, and then you'd need to test it with people to make sure that it works in all sorts of different environments. It must be quite a bit of an undertaking.
Yes, but fortunately, because of where when I lost my sight, I'm able to draw attention, so I can spend full time doing this. And so I can put a game together in 2-3 weeks usually, from concept to testing. And then the testing, depending on, you know, how well I did on the coding, the testing might take a week or two, but so far things have been going well, and I can produce a game in about a 3-week time. Period.
That's quite remarkable, because when did Yahtzee first come out?
I had several of these written. I had Yahtzee, Battleship, Simon written, and then I released them on the market January 28th. And then since then, I've added the others. I've written and added the others.
And how many do you have now? Can you give us a bit of a rundown of the different games that you have?
Yes. Right now, I currently have 7 games. Accessible Battleship, Accessible Blackjack, Accessible Pre-Cell, Accessible Memory, Accessible Simon, Accessible Wordplay, and Accessible Yahtzee. Accessible Wordplay is my latest release. It was just released over the weekend. I think it's a lot of fun and has some good sound effects in it.
And people are able to go onto your website, which is now www.gamesfortheblind.com, and download demos of these. Are people buying them? Are you getting the kind of revenue you expected to get from these games?
Yes. Yes. The response has been overwhelming. I sell the games for $10 a piece. I'm not in this for the money. This is something so I don't lose my mind with all the time I have on my hands. And I just really enjoy the process of writing computer software. So the money that I charge, I only charge $10 per copy, just to recover the losses of buying computers, the compilers that I need, the software for editing sound files, things like that.
You were saying that you're more than happy with the kind of response that you've received. Has it exceeded your expectations?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Yeah, oh, yes. It's been overwhelming. Yes. I'm surprised at the email I get from people that just thank me so much for this, because they weren't able to find any games before. Blind children that are finding, you know, games now, and that just really excites me. I really love the feedback. I I encourage people to give me feedback, because that's what keeps me going. It's like, hey, the $10 a copy isn't going to make me rich. So I just really enjoyed the feedback. And actually, I haven't gotten too many reports of bugs. They've been relatively bug-free.
What do you program in?
I use Visual Basic. Visual C++ is a very, very, very good language, but the learning curve is quite high. I was a very good C programmer back in DOS days, but I haven't wanted to go through the learning process of C++ and Windows. And Visual Basic is much easier for string manipulation. So I write everything in Visual Basic. And with Visual Basic 7, I'm sure we'll be able to do a lot more.
Well, I'm led to believe that in Visual Basic, and perhaps some other languages, but I'm led to believe certainly Visual Basic, they actually have built active accessibility right into some of the controls. Is that correct?
Yes. And that's one nice thing is, for example, the how I play the audio files. I could use the Windows API to play audio files, but I purchased an ActiveX control very cheaply, and it just allows it so much easier, and it's very predictable. So it's just easier to use that. You can just plug that right into the program and go, and now all of a sudden, you play a sound file. And there's more and more ActiveX controls on the market all the time.
Now, do you have any advice for people who have software synthesizers? Because I suppose there will be some conflict between the sounds that your games make and software speech unless people have a multi-channel sound card.
I test all of my games on computers with the single-channel sound card and multi-channel. That's the delicate balance that I have. Is keeping JAWS and the sound files from stepping on each other. I have to do it on a timing basis at this time. It will be really nice once everybody has multi-channel sound cards. Once we all have multi-channel sound cards, then that will really help open up the game world for us too, because of the speech synthesizers. So the games can't get too advanced until we have that. What I really wanted to look into right now is DirectX. I've been playing with DirectX a lot. Real-time mixing of audio during the game. Could it have what we're looking for is a three-dimensional sound field. And once the technology catches up with us, so that it's affordable to have surround sound speakers, say, for your computer, then you would have a game environment where it would be three-dimensional audio. You have somebody shooting at you from the front or from the side or from, the back. You can tell where they're at. Then, you're going to have to maneuver and respond to whatever that activity is.
The games that you have, you've got to have JFW in order to play the games. Is that right?
At this point, but that's where we're working at this. Well, I'm working at right now is all games from now on will be released so WindowEyes users can play them also. And then I will backtrack and work on the existing games and make them compliant as time permits.
What is it with the games at the moment that ties them to JFW so closely?
JF, Henner Joyce provided me with an interface directly to JFW. WindowEyes does not have an interface that will directly interface to WindowEyes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the applications totally self-voicey. So WindowEyes users and anybody, even people without a screen reader, can play them. It will use the Microsoft text-to-speech engine and be totally self-voicey. And that way, then, for WindowEyes users, they can use the set file to put WindowEyes to sleep or whatever it's called in WindowEyes, and then just allow the game to talk. And then that way, even people without screen readers would be able to play the games because it would be using the Microsoft TTS engine.
Well, that will broaden your market considerably.
Yes, it will. And that'll be happening right away. That's the next thing that's happening. Production of the games will slow down a little bit while I'm doing that. But then once I have that module built, then I can just plug that into every game and then the development cycle will be able to continue.
Have you had a look at playing games across the internet so that blind people can have tournaments of different types of games? I guess Battleships is ideally suited to that, and there are other games that you probably have yet to write that would be ideal for internet play.
Yes, that is definitely my ultimate goal, is games over the internet. Poker, I was just discussing with one of my customers the other day, poker over the internet, that would be fantastic. Battleship, I mean, there's so many games we could do over the internet. At this point, it's difficult money-wise to do it because of the technology needed. Writing the programs themselves, I could write those right now. But I need a dedicated server in order to run the server-side application on. And that's basically what's holding things up, is being able to find a dedicated server to run the server application.
So with a machine that would run a server like that, is the issue the processor power involved or the bandwidth that would be used or both?
It's basically because the web host that I've talked to, when you rent web space from a web host, there may be 100, 150 users on one server, 100 or 150 domains on one server. And if everybody was running applications such as mine, it would slow the servers down too much and cause them, you know, poor service. So they won't allow me to run, you know, a server-side application like that. And what I need to go to is a dedicated server where the server only runs my material. Ideally, I would just like to go ahead and set up a server right here in my home, and then, boy, then we would be playing games over the internet very quickly.
What other projects do you have in the works at the moment that you might be able to tell us about, if anything?
Well, the next game will be Word Jumble. It'll be words that are jumbled up and you have to put them in a correct order. More solitaire card games. I'm getting a lot of requests for more solitaire card games. More games with sound effects, but actually, like I say, production will slow down on the games as I can, if I can find a way to host my server applications, then all my attention will be mainly directed towards internet gaming.
Another thing that people will definitely want me to ask you is e-commerce. Will there be a point at which people can log on when their demo's up and go to a web page and purchase the registered version?
Yes, most definitely. I'm in negotiations with some companies right now, but because I keep my price low at $10 a copy, I don't have much to play with. So if a company wants to charge me 25% to handle the credit card orders, because that's quite a bit being taken out of my $10. And the only way that I can continue to write these games and hopefully get a server of my own and things like that is by, you know, with this money. And so I can't afford to pay 25% of it to somebody just take my credit card orders. So we're talking to different companies right now. We're hoping something looks really promising right now that maybe within 3 or 4 weeks we may be able to be up and running with that.
And that's Robert Betts from GamesForTheBlind.com on ACB Radio's Main Menu.
Hi all. Welcome again to another review of some fine software here on acbradio.org's Main Menu. My name's Scott Rutkowski, and today I've decided to review a fine piece of CDR software, and it's a really good piece of software this. It's called Audio CD MP3 Studio 2000. This piece of software is for burning WAV files and MP3 files to CD, to audio CD. It's not for burning data to CD, just for WAV files and MP3s to audio CDs that you can play in your car or your stereo, wherever you like to play them. Okay, let's get started. Basically, this software is, I think, $20 US to register. Fine piece of software, as I've said, and we'll just give a brief demo of some of the features that this program has and the way you go about adding tracks to the CD. First of all, This program is very speech friendly with Window Eyes and JFW, and it's worth noting that once you actually use the program in the demo mode or in the shareware mode, it adds a 30-second jingle to the beginning of every CD you burn with the program. You can actually get through this actual software itself a trial key, which runs forever, and it gives you full functionality without the 30-second jingle at the start of every CD you burn, but a banner is displayed at the bottom of the screen, and that may or may not get in the way, depending on how your screen is set up, that sort of thing. Okay, basically, I'll show you the pull-down menus in Audio CD MP3 2000, and you'll be able to see some of the functions that you have. So we'll just alt-tab to the program now.
Untitled Audio CD MP3 Studio 2000. Untitled Audio CD MP3 Studio 2000. List view, 0 items.
Okay, so basically you get a list box when you go into the program, and at the moment the list box is blank. That's where all your tracks get added to once you add some tracks. So the pull-down menus are as follows.
Menu bar, file.
File.
Edit.
Edit.
CD.
CD.
Options.
Options.
Internet.
Internet.
Question.
And question is the help menu. And they're the menus.
Leaving menu.
Okay, so to add a file, or yeah, to add an MP3 or WAV file to the CD, you just do an Alt-E for edit.
Alt-E, menu active, edit, add tracks.
Add tracks. So press enter on add tracks.
Enter, leaving menus, open dialog, file name.
I'll just type in the full path to the files.
C, colon, backslash.
And hit enter.
MP3, enter, C.
Okay, I'll just arrow shift-tab back to the list box, where all the files are listed.
Shift-tab, list view, big country, enable big country, MP3.
Okay, that's the one I want to add. So I'll press enter on that.
Enter, list view, 1358:06.
Okay, so that's one file added. Now, the only problem with the program, and I could probably just simply write a script for JFW, but it's not too bad. If you do an insert 3,
four.
It doesn't actually say how long the track goes for. So what you normally have to do, and it's not too hard, you just route JAWS to PC.
Route JAWS to PC.
Press page down.
Page down.
And read, hit the up arrow once.
Tracks, 01.
So one track, and the next line up.
Time, 04:00.
So 4 minutes exactly that track goes for.
PC.
We'll just add one more track.
1358:06, C. Backslash.
Okay, that's the actual file name of the track I've just added, so we'll go Alt-E again.
Alt-E, menu active, edit, add tracks.
Add tracks.
Enter menu.
And type in the path. You've got to type in the path every time you want to add a track, I think.
C, from
what I've
backslash.
Discovered of the program anyway. Okay, let's just
shift
pick
tab.
Another track at random.
Christina Aguilera.
This will do. We'll just add that.
Enter list view 13.
So now we've got two tracks.
1358:2. What a girl wants. Christina Aguilera.
Okay, so we'll just have a look and see how long it goes for.
Root tape time. 07:56.
Okay, 7 minutes, 56 seconds. Okay. The only problem that I've found with the program, and I'm in consultation with the author now, for some reason, it doesn't recognize CDs that are greater than 72 minutes. That's the only problem I've found so far with the program. But to be perfectly honest, 72 minutes is more than enough. You only lose 2 minutes anyway off a 74-minute CD. You can buy 80-minute CDs now, and unfortunately this program doesn't support 80-minute CDs at this time, and I am writing to the author in regard to the issue. The other nice thing about this program, and I haven't seen any other CDR software that does this, before it actually writes all your MP3s or WAV files to CD, it'll automatically normalize the MP3 files for you, or the WAV files, and then it'll actually write them to audio CD. So basically, everybody's come across this before, I'm sure, where you've got a whole heap of MP3s, and some may be louder than others, and some may be softer than others. And normally when you're playing them, you get around that issue with Audio Stalker, which is a plugin for Winamp. With this piece of software, you just select all your tracks like we've just done earlier, and then you can simply just go to the CD menu, which we'll do right now.
PC cursor.
Hang on a second, we'll just do that.
Title equals untitled audio.
Okay.
PC.
So you just go to CD.
Wall.
Okay, let's do that now.
Alt C. Root. File menu. Left. Hub. Edit. CD. Met. Left mouse button. Menu bar. PC. Read CD.
Okay. Don't know what happened there, but I have to use the mouse pointer to go to the actual CD menu, but that's not normally the case. So you've got read CD.
Write CD.
Write CD.
Read CD.
Okay, and they're the only two. So we'll choose
write CD.
Write CD.
Enter menu bar. Leaving menu bar. Write CD dialog. Information. Simulation mode. Checkbox not checked.
Simulation mode. That means it'll just, it won't actually write the CD. It'll actually just test it to make sure your equipment can handle it. That sort of thing. I'd recommend that to anybody first of all. Before they actually go and actually burn a CD and waste one, make sure you tick simulation mode. And the actual write laser, which writes the CD, won't be used in this mode. It'll just say whether it passes or fails. Recommended. Okay, the next option that we have...
Tab, information, normalize, checkbox checked.
Normalize, yes. You definitely want to make sure that option is ticked, otherwise some of your MP3s may come out softer than others, and that's quite annoying. So yeah, tick that box. The next option that you have...
Tab, information, write speed, combo box, 2x.
Write speed. At the moment it's set to 2 times, or 2x. That's fine for most people. You can attempt 4 if you wish, but for some reason it didn't work here at my end. I had to use 2 times to actually write the CD. Now, keep in mind that if you have, say, 70 minutes of audio on the CD, it actually goes through track by track before it writes it, normalizes everything, and then it'll actually write your CD for you. Overall, this program is very, very cool. I'm going to give it 10 out of 10. Actually, I'll give it 8 out of 10 due to the fact that it doesn't support anything over 72 minutes, which is quite a shame, actually. But yeah, I'll just see if there's any other options here.
Tab, information, no, of copies, edit 1.
Okay, number of copies, you can have like 2, 3, 4 copies, whatever. It's set to 1 right now.
Tab, right button.
And then there's your right button.
2, what, 8?
So basically, the program is very speech-friendly, except for that little thing in regards to finding out how much time you've used on your CD.
Untitled. Cool edit.
And once you've done that, you actually, yeah. So basically, to explain it again, you just copy all your tracks. They can be on any drive on your hard disk. You just select them like we did earlier, and then choose the CD menu, and then write CD. Make sure you've got normalized ticked and the write speed, and then click on write. It'll pop up a dialog telling you how many tracks, the time of the total CD, that sort of thing. Just choose OK. And it'll begin to normalize all your tracks. Then it'll write the CD. If anybody wants to ask any questions about the program, or even better, download it, they can go to www.download.com would be the best place to get this from. The developer's website is quite difficult to navigate. It's not one of the most speech-friendliest websites I've come across on the internet. So I would go to download.com, do a search for audio CD MP3, that'll be enough to find the program. And the latest version of the program is Audio CD MP3 2000 version 2.05C. Give it a try. You've got nothing to lose, basically. And as I say, you can get a trial key. The actual text file that, when you're installing it, it'll come up with a text file explaining what the limitations are in the shareware version. And it'll actually work quite well. So yeah, Audio CD MP3 2000, give it a try, and I hope many people find this program to be of some value. This is Scott Rutkowski for acbradio.org.
The internet gives us access to a vast quantity of information, and if you use the right search engine, you can generally search just about anything and get a result. The trouble is that the quality of a lot of that information is a little dubious. That's why I'm always on the hunt for good quality research tools, and a couple of weeks ago I found one and decided to investigate. It's called Know UK, and the National Library for the Blind of the UK offers blind people free access to the service. We'll talk some more about Know UK shortly and indeed demonstrate it, but I have on the line Joanna Widows from the National Library of the Blind of the UK. Joanna, I thought it might be useful, before we talk about Know UK, if you can tell us a little bit about the library itself and the services that you offer.
Well, the National Library for the Blind UK is actually a charitable organisation, and we are a gateway, I suppose, to free and comprehensive library services for all those that can't read print and their intermediaries. And it's our aim to ensure that that all visually impaired people have the same access to library services as sighted people. And I guess in the past, we've traditionally been a Braille lending library, and we lend a wide range of material for all age groups, and we have an extensive collection of hard copy Braille books. But now we're moving into a lot of electronic services, so we're now providing electronic books and electronic reference material to our users as well.
I note that you make a point of saying in the publicity that surrounds Know UK, for instance, that you don't have to be living in the United Kingdom to belong to the library. Do you have many people outside the UK that you provide services to at this point?
That's right, yes. We do have an increasing number of people who are using our services from outside the UK, although the majority of our users are still UK users. Particularly with, as we're expanding our services to include more electronic services, that's attracting a lot of people from outside of the UK to join the library and to use our services via the web.
So what other electronic services besides Know UK, which we'll come to shortly, do you offer? You mentioned electronic text. Does that mean that I'm able to download texts from the internet or get them sent to me on floppy disk? How does it all work?
We do have some electronic text which you can download directly from our website. We also have some books that are on disk which you can borrow from the library. We actually also have a pilot project with a company called Online Originals, who are an electronic book publisher. And they supply books which are original copyright works, and that they're by contemporary authors, because many electronic books that you tend to find available on the internet are things that are out of copyright, and we wanted to provide something for our readers that was a bit more contemporary. And among the titles that they actually offer is the first electronic book which was ever to be nominated for the Booker Prize, and that's The Angels of Russia. And we've actually negotiated a deal with Online Originals, whereby National Library for the Blind readers are entitled to access three Online Originals electronic books for free via their website, which you can access via the NLB website. And readers from the NLB can simply order books online using their National Library for the Blind reader number, and then books are sent to them via email.
Are you observing a trend that there is an increasing interest in the general community in electronic books? Because I note recently that there was a lot of noise about Stephen King and the fact that he had published a book on the internet without actually publishing it in print. Do you think this is a trend that we will see emerging?
I think so, definitely. I think I know that we're definitely getting an increasing number of people asking for books in electronic format. Unfortunately, in the UK, we have some problems with with copyright, which makes it very difficult for us to offer a lot of our books electronically. But this is something that we're investigating, and we're hoping to be able to introduce maybe secure means of delivering electronic books, which would hopefully overcome copyright problems. And this would allow us to expand the range of books that we're able to make available electronically.
Now, one deal, as it were, that you have been able to do for your borrowers, your clients, is with the Know UK website, and that's how I found out about the work that the library was doing. This is a phenomenal research resource. Tell us a little bit about it, and also how it came to be that your library users have been able to have this access.
Right. Well, I guess we've been feeling for a while that the electronic medium was really the ideal medium for providing reference information, particularly as we were trying to meet the needs of visually impaired people, and reference material has been something that's been quite difficult to put into Braille in the past, because Braille is a very linear medium, and it can be quite difficult to search, and it's also quite time consuming to put things into Braille, and so often by the time the reference material was put into Braille, it would be out of date. So we felt that we wanted to look for an electronic resource. And when we found Know UK, we thought that something like that would be ideal for our readers. And then we had a look at the website, and there were a few minor sort of access problems. But generally, the accessibility of the site was very good. So we worked with them to improve the accessibility. And I should say that Know UK is actually a subscription service, so it's not normally freely available to everybody. But we negotiated a subscription deal with the publishers, Chadwick Keeley, whereby we can offer Know UK freely to members of the National Library for the Blind. So basically, to get free access to Know UK, you need to join the National Library for the Blind UK. But all our services are free and international, and it's very quick and simple to join the library. Anyone can join the library. You don't have to be registered, blind or partially sighted. And you can join via our website, which is www.nlvuk.org. And once you've joined the library, you can simply send us an email requesting password, which will give you access to Know UK. And we can send that to you, and you can access Know UK immediately.
Given that it's such a massive resource, I mean, we're talking many dozens of useful publications on there that are all searchable. How much would people normally expect to pay for accessing a service like that?
Well, at the moment, It's actually not in I don't believe it's available for individuals to subscribe to. It's at the moment it's only available, I think, for organisations such as libraries to subscribe to it. And obviously the subscription will vary depending on the size of the organisation and the number of people that they're serving.
And obviously I wouldn't expect you to reel them all off, but can you give us a bit of an example of the wealth of resources that one can access through the Know UK service?
Well, certainly. I mean, there's a wealth of information contained in Know UK. It's a collection of over 70 of the most heavily used reference resources in British libraries. It includes things like Hutchinson's Encyclopedia of Britain, Who's Who, there's The Witch Guide to Complementary Medicine, there's the Statesman of the Year book, there's guides to walking and to good pubs. I mean, there's information on a really wide range of subjects, bibliographical information, community, voluntary, education, government, health, law, religion, leisure, media. I mean, there should be something for everyone, I think, there's such a huge amount. some of the resources do have a UK focus, but many of them will be of interest to people across the world.
How has the take-up been in terms of people taking up this offer and using the service?
We've had a tremendous amount of interest. We do have a limit on the number of people that we can hand out passwords to. But at the moment, it's quite a high limit, so we're a long way from reaching that limit yet. But in the short time that we've made it available to our readers, there's been a great amount of interest, and we've had a lot of new people joining the library specifically to access Know UK.
Have you collected any data, or has anyone in the UK collected any data about how many blind people are using the internet in that part of the world?
We haven't collected any data ourselves, although I believe that's an area that we're going to be looking into in the future, because we feel that that's certainly going to be a very important thing for us to know in terms of developing our electronic services.
Well, that's excellent. So just remind us, as we conclude, the web address for people who would like to know more about not just Know UK, but the interesting other services that your library offers.
Right. Well, our website address is www.nlbuk.org. And all the services that I've mentioned today are available on that website. If I can just give you my email address as well, if people would like to contact me directly. It's Joanna, that's J-O-A-N-N-A dot widows, W-I-D-D-O-W-S, at nlbuk.org.
Well, Joanna has given me the password information to get on to Know UK, and I've been there. I've already put it in my favourites because I think it's a fantastic site, and I thought I'd demonstrate to you how much power there is on this Know UK site, which is available to anyone who wants to register free of charge with the National Library for the Blind of the UK. Now, for this demonstration, I'm using Window Eyes, so there we go, no one can accuse us of imbalance. Now, we're going to go to the start menu and go to favorites.
Start menu. A equals. Favorites pull-down. M
now,
equals. Microsoft Picture It.
We have quite page. A few favorites folders here because I've got so many favorites. If I didn't organize them into nice little categories, it would be madness. So we'll go into the reference folder.
R equals. Reference pull-down. K equals. Noah homepage.
And there's the Know UK homepage. Right with focus, so we'll push enter.
Start button.
And we are now loading
head the box. P equals password. Dialogue. Enter network password.
Okay, so what we have here is a standard network type user ID and password box. This is a good thing for web page authors to do who want to protect their pages, in my opinion, because you can save the password in your password list if you want to, assuming that no one else who you don't want to have the password uses the computer that you're using. And I have saved the user ID and password information, so in this case,
Microsoft Internet Explorer,
I can just hit enter, and
custom control.
That will let me in, with a bit of luck, to the Know UK homepage, and we can explore this just a little bit, and find out exactly how we can do a search on all of the resources.
Load page.
Okay, so just to speed this up a little, if I read the title of the homepage here.
Noah homepage, Microsoft Internet Explorer.
So we know we're at the right place. We can, of course, read to end and hear what's here.
Edit box. Go. Button. Also available button. Advanced search visited link.
Now, Window Eyes has actually taken me straight to the search field here, so.
Edit box.
Let's just do that. We'll turn MSA mode off.
MSA mode off.
And I'm just going to type in a search. This is the simple search. So if you suddenly decide that you need to do a bit of research about something and you want to just quickly see what it brings up, you can do that here. Now, as an example, let's see if we can find some information on David Blunkett, who is a blind politician in the UK. He is, in fact, the Secretary of Education, last I heard. So that's a real achievement. So let's just type in David Blunkett and tap to the go button.
Go button.
And hit the space bar. And now we'll turn
list of results.
The MSAA mode on. So you see it was actually quite quick in giving us
loading
the
page. Load done.
information that we wanted. Now I can just hit the window-wise combination to get past the common list of links at the top of the page.
Top of page banner. List of results page banner. UK image. Back to NOAC homepage visit link.
I'm narrowing down a line at a time here.
What's the NOAC visit link? Help link. You search NOAC for the keywords. David Blunkett. NOAC has found 100 records in the list of results.
Okay,
click on the link log of you.
Yeah, it's found 100 records already. And actually, that seems to be the maximum that it will display at any one time. So it's obviously, it knows a lot about David Blunkett. And let's just tab through these results and see exactly the type of stuff that they've given us.
Help box for the list visited link. Two link. Three link.
Now, that's a pretty standard procedure. You've got the different pages of the search results.
Four link. Five link. Blunkett R.T. Hahn. David DeBrapp's People of Today link.
Okay, so there we go. We've got a biographical type piece here about the Right Honourable David Blunkett from the DeBrett's People of Today publication.
Blunkett, R.T. Hahn, David House of Commons Biographies link.
Now that's the House of Commons biography. I think that'd be quite interesting to look. We'll just tab through though and see what else we've got.
Blunkett, David 1947, The Hutchinson Encyclopedia of Britain link. Blunkett, R.T. Hahn, David was the link.
Well, there's Who's Who, that most prestigious of publications is here, and he's made it into Who's Who.
Fran, Hillary House of Commons Biographies link. British education in the 20th century, some key dates of the Hutchinson Encyclopedia of Britain link.
Well, that's interesting. That's obviously referring to David Blunkett because he's Education Secretary.
Quite well. Christopher Parliamentary Candidates Biographies link.
And what you can find, of course, is that the article may not necessarily be about David Blunkett. He may be discussed in connection with election campaigns or whatever it might be.
Butler, Francis Parliamentary Candidates Biographies link. Carter, Matthew Parliamentary Candidates Biographies link.
Maybe these are people who stood against David Blunkett. So let's just back tab through here. The No UK system also has Hansard, which is the official record of Parliament in the UK. And so no doubt there'll be lots of David Blunkett speeches. In fact, if we typed in the right search, we may even be able to get his maiden speech. It'd be quite interesting to look at some stage. But in the meantime, let's back tab and have a look at Who's Who, which is something that I've always been interested in reading.
Butler, Grant.
At least having access to.
Quite well. Rivish, Grant, Hillary, Blunkett, R.T. Hahn. David was the link.
Okay, that's what we want. So I just hit enter on that link, and it's gone away to think about life.
Loading page.
And
load
it's
done.
Thought enough, and it's loaded the page. So I am now going to just move WindowWise to the point where we get the stuff.
Top of page banner. Will be blue lock. Back to NOAC home page. What's the NOAC visit? Help link. Boys with the hit marker. Simple. 8085 Nopram's home search at Go Back List of Result Logo. Source. Who's the 2000. Publisher. The C Black. Category. Biographies. Date of publication. 13th January 2nd 1000.
That's interesting. Where did you get 2nd 1000 from? Sometimes the deck talk does some bizarre stuff like that.
Page.
Now, we're on to the full stuff. So, what you see here to start with is that it's a proper bibliographical reference type thing. I mean, it gives you the reference that you would need if you were going to be quoting this in any way in some sort of academic work. Now, I'm just going to set WindowWise reading.
H. Blunkett, R.T. Hahn. H. David. Details. PC 1997 MP Lab Sheffield, Brightside, since 1987 Secretary of State for Education and Employment since 1997. Born, 6 June 1947. Married, Mayor, Dis, 3, Son S, Education Career, Knight SCH, and Day Release Shrewsbury Cull, of Technol, and Richmond Cull, of Further, Edgic, Sheffield, Nat, Cert, in Business Studies, E. Midlands Gas BD, Sheffield University, Bahans Paul Theory and Denson's Adrisfield Holly Bank Cull, of Edgic Tech, Fee, Tour in Industrial Realms, Barnsley Cull, of TECHNOL period, 1974.
Now there's a lot of abbreviations in this stuff that people may not be familiar with.
1970CHM period, Family and Community Services Key, 1976-80, Leader, 1980-87 Dep, CHM period, AMA, 1984-87, Joined Labour Party at age of 60CHM period, Labour Party NEC, 1993-94 Dep, CHM period, 1992-93 MEM period, 1983-98 CHM period,
okay.
Labour Party. On local guard.
So it's going to tell us David Blunkett's life history and education and marital status and everything you wanted to know but were too afraid to ask. So that's a good way of looking up somebody just by entering in a keyword, in that case a name, and that's pretty comprehensive, and it will allow you to go through all those different searches. So the Hutchinson Encyclopedia, for example, may have an angle or a useful piece of fact that Who's Who doesn't have, or whatever. So let's go back to the home page. I think if we bring up the list of links with Windowizers, insert tab command,
dial
and push G for go to No UK Home.
Go to No UK Home.
Okay, we're going to go back to the No UK Home, and this time we'll try an advanced search, because at the same time it will show us the different sources that we can choose from, and we can narrow the search down to any of these individual sources that we want. So let me just go to the first edit field.
Go button.
Oh, it's a go button, because I was already on the edit. I like that.
Go.
A go button.
Also available button. Advanced search visit.
Okay, so we're going to go to the advanced search now. And what I'm going to do now is see if I can get some useful information on the Archers. And for those of you who've followed any list I run or listened to other programming that I've done, I'm a big fan of the Archers, which is the longest running radio soap opera. Well, it's the longest running soap opera of any kind in the history of electronic media, which is no mean achievement, and it's still going strong. So, let's go to the first edit field.
Edit box.
Now.
MSN mode off.
So, Windowise has plonked me in the keywords edit box, and I'm just going to type, in quotes, the Archers. And I'm going to tab.
Person organization name. Edit box.
Now, we could try typing BBC in there, just to narrow it down.
Town, county, postcode. Edit box.
We'll leave that alone, because I don't know what the postcode for Ambridge is.
Edit box.
And Windowise isn't speaking that, which is not very helpful. So what we can do is we can
MSA mode on.
Turn MSAA mode on, and we will find the surrounding information.
Heading.
Heading, okay.
Edit.
So that's if you want to have the article heading specified to narrow the search even further. You could put that here.
Go.
And there's the go button. Now, what's interesting, though, is that if you keep tabbing, you can actually select the sources that you're going to choose from.
All biographies. Checkbox. Uncheck.
What they've done is they've divided everything into sensible categories, and you can choose all of any one of those categories. For example, the first checkbox here is all biographies, which I will actually check.
Checked.
But by hitting the space bar. But then if you wanted to be more selective, you can select them one by one.
Civil service biographies. Checkbox. Unchecked. Concise dictionary of national biography. The Brett people of today. European parliamentary biographies. House of Commons biographies. House of Lords biographies. Northern Ireland Assembly biographies.
I mean, you can see it's incredibly comprehensive.
Parliamentary candidates biographies. Scottish parliamentary biographies. Titles and forms of address.
That's quite useful.
Welsh Assembly biographies. Check.
Next time I meet the Queen.
Who's who? Check. Who was who? Check. All community and voluntary. Directory of British self-help groups and organizations. Directory of crematoria. Check. Housing care homes for older people. UK advice finder. The voluntary agencies directory. All education. Check.
Okay, so now we're going to the education sector.
British qualifications.
I'm just tabbing through this list of checkboxes, and as you can hear, Windowise is speaking those perfectly. And if I held on long enough before hitting the tab key, it will tell me the status of each checkbox, which is all unchecked, apart from the all biographies one, which I've checked.
Education authorities directory and annual. Checkbox. Unchecked. The Capital's Guide to Independent Schools. The Capital's Guide to Schools for Special Needs. Primary Education Directory. Special Education Directory.
Okay, so you can see there are some good disability resources here.
UK Course Discover. The Witch. Guide to Choosing a Career. All Government. Checkbox.
Okay, now we get into the governmental stuff.
The Air Force List. The Army List. The Civil Service Guide. The Diplomatic Service List. Municipal Yearbook. The Navy List. All Health. Brindley's Directory of NHS Management.
So, yeah, All Health. Now we're into the health stuff.
Brindley's Directory of Primary Care. The British Confederation of Psychotherapists Register. Held on the Internet. The Opticians Register. The Witch. Guide to Complementary Medicine. Witch. Medicine. All information sources. Checkbox. British Archives.
The British Archives may well have something.
Check.
We'll check the British Archives.
The British Library World. Checkbox. Uncheck.
I don't know about that one.
The Chadwick Hill Directory of Associations. Digest of Museum Statistics Domus. The Hutchinson Almanac. Check.
Well, that might.
Check. The Hutchinson Encyclopedia of Britain.
So might that.
Check. The Hutchinson Gazetteer of the UK. The Statesman's Yearbook 2000. A law. Check
okay,
box.
Okay, now law
the
resources.
Law Society's Directory of Solicitors and Barristers. 401 Legal Problems Solved. The Scottish Law Directory. Willing's Press Guide. Religions in the UK. All travel. Check. Blue Guide Channel Islands.
They might have an Ambridge travel guide.
Blue Guide Country Houses of England. Blue Guide England. Blue Guide Ireland. Blue Guide London. Blue Guide Oxford and Cambridge.
So this is great, of course, if you're a person with a disability and you really want to try and plan your tour and find out what's available. You can search these travel guides for very good information.
Blue Guide Scotland. Blue Guide Wales. The Good Bed and Breakfast Guide. The Good Food Guide 2000. The Good Walks Guide. Great Days Out.
And remember that these are all generally print publications that are now searchable.
The Witch, Guide to Country Pubs.
Oh, very nice.
The Witch, Guide to Scotland.
But you don't get Budweiser over there.
The Witch, Guide to Weekend Breaks in Britain. The Witch, Hotel Guide 2000. The Witch, Wine Guide 2000. Go.
Okay, finally we've gone through the resources, so you can see that is just remarkable. Now we're going to hit the go button, and what we've done is we've searched the Archers on all biographies, and we have also searched a couple of the information sources, such as the British Library, and we will see what it delivers.
Downloading
we're
page.
Still downloading the page, that's fine, it's gone
loading
away.
Loading page.
Okay.
Well done.
And we'll get past the stuff.
Top of list of results. UK image. Back to Noic. What's the Noic visited? Help link. You search Noic for. The keywords, the Archers, the name, BBC, in the publications, British Archives, the Hutchinson Almanac, the Hutchinson Encyclopedia of Britain.
Okay, it's telling me what I'm searching.
All biographies, Noic has found zero records.
Well, that's fine. I suspect that if I did a search for the... In fact, why don't we do that? I mean, we're going to sometimes have issues where we don't get it right. So well, how about if I go back and take the BBC out?
Edit box the Archers.
So I've just gone to the first edit field with Windowizer's Control-Alt-Down-Arrow command.
Edit box BBC.
And I'm going to just
MSA mode off.
Turn MSA mode off and take BBC out with Control-A and a delete.
Person organization name.
Now it's blank. So we will
MSA mode on.
Turn MSA mode on. And I think the easiest way to handle
loading
this, because it's such a big form, we'll go to the bottom of the page.
Button.
And then do a Control-Alt-Up-Arrow.
Go.
We're right on the go button.
MSA mode on.
We'll resubmit that search without the BBC in it. And we'll just see what happens here.
Noic list of results. Noic list of results.
Okay.
MSA mode on.
Turn the old MSA mode on. And we'll...
Loading page. Look. Top of UK. Rank. What? Helpful use of the keywords. The in the grip. The Hutchinson.
I'm just quickly airing through this.
The Hutchinson and Albright Noic, the relevant book, Noic has found 23 records in the list of results.
Look at that. Okay, by taking BBC out, it's happy, and it's found 23 references to the Archers. I'll just see whether it, in fact, has found what I was looking for, because that's one of the big problems with searches.
Help box for the two links. Whitburn, Vanessa Victoria to Grabs People of Today link.
Okay, well, that's a good find, because that's some information about the chief editor for the Archers program, Vanessa Whitburn.
Green, Patricia Honor to Brett's People of Today link.
And that's another good one.
Powell, Michael Latham, 1905-1990, who was the link. Collingwood, Charles Henry to Brett's People of Today link.
He plays the somewhat dodgy Brian Aldridge in The Archers, so it's definitely found what I was looking for.
Gallagher, Jock James Young to Brett's People of Today link. Gallimore, Patricia Mary to Brett's People. Painting, Norman George to Brett's People of Today link.
Of course, Norman Painting's been with it from the beginning as Philip Archer. So there you go, you see. We have a nice list of search terms that I will actually read every article on now. And that is Know UK, as Joanna mentioned. It's available free to anyone in the world if you become a member of the National Library for the Blind of the UK, which is also a free process. Go to www.nlbuk.org. This is Main Menu on ACB Radio Mainstream, heard 9 till 11 Eastern every Sunday evenings, 1 till 3 GMT on Monday, and then of course available on demand on our website at www.acbradio.org. Now we return to our weekly Look at Linux series with Matt Campbell, our Linux guru. Last week he helped us unzip the ZipSpeak talking installation of Linux, and we did a couple of things to get it all ready to go. Now we're going to make some final modifications before we can start Linux and learn a little bit about how hard drives are referenced in Linux. Here's Matt with this week's Look at Linux.
You start ZipSpeak from DOS mode, using a batch file under the Linux directory called linux.bat. And before you can start ZipSpeak, you have to edit the batch file to point to your particular hard disk. And under Linux, hard disks don't have drive letters as they do under DOS and Windows. Instead, they are referred to by device names, which start with /dev, because that's the directory where all the device files are under the Linux file system. So, let me try to explain how device names for hard drives and their partitions work. First of all, after the /dev, you have another slash, of course. And then the first letter in the device name for a hard drive is either an H or an S. If it's an H, then it's an IDE hard drive, which is the type of hard drive that's most common in PCs. If it's an S, then that indicates an SCSI or SCSI drive, which is less common, but I hear that it's somewhat faster. The next letter is always a D, and then the next letter indicates which hard drive it is. So, for example, the first IDE hard drive would be /dev/HDA, and the second hard drive would be /dev/SDB, and so on. So that's the device file name for the hard drive itself, and that's just the whole drive, not split into partitions. For any given partition on the hard drive, the device file name starts the same as the name for the hard drive itself, and then there's a number. On any drive, the four primary partitions on the drive are numbered from 1 to 4. Then, if your drive has any logical partitions, those are numbered starting at 5. So, for example, the C drive on a PC would normally be /dev/HDA1, since that's the first partition on the first IDE drive in the system. I also have an extended partition which contains some logical partitions for both Windows and Linux file systems. So my D drive, to use the Windows terminology, would be /dev/HDA5 under Linux, because it's the first logical partition under my extended partition. But anyway, I've got ZipSpeak installed on my C drive, so now I'm going to show you how to edit the batch file, linux.bat, to point to that drive, now that I've explained, or at least tried to explain, how Linux device file names for hard drives work. So, let me get out of the DOS box that I'm in at the moment, and back to the Windows desktop. And now I'm going to get into Notepad, so I can edit the file.
Window title and type the name of the program, folder, document, open, open, /LIMUX/LIMUX, period, /LIMUX, Windows title, text, okay.
You can tell I'm a command line fan even when I'm in Windows. Anyway, first, in the default linux.bat file, there are several lines that are commented out with a rem statement, and there's one line that's not commented out, which contains a command to start Linux. And in the default linux.bat file, the one line which is not commented out is 4/dev/SDA4, which is some partition on a SCSI drive. So I need to find that line and make it into a comment by adding rem to the beginning of it.
Rem partition. In the end, rem to refer to the partition. Rem that you put in on. Rem to the section. Rem for shift. Rem delay. Rem for delay. Rem at the end of. Rem. Rem PR sum. /Linux. /Linux.
Okay, got that taken care of. Now, there's another line which is commented out, which points to /dev/HDA1, which is the drive that we want. So I'm going to find that line and remove the word rem from the beginning to make that into the actual command to start the system. No, we don't have a zip drive. That's it. So I'm going to press the delete key 4 times to get rid of the letters R, E, M, and a space. And now the character under the cursor is a backslash, which is what we want. So I'm going to save the file and get out of Notepad. Okay, I think that's the hardest part of the initial installation. To start Linux, you have to be in DOS mode. Not in a DOS box inside Windows, but in DOS mode. And an easy way to get there from Windows is to choose Restart the Computer in DOS mode from the shutdown dialog. Now, if you're going to do this, you need to be sure that config.sys loads both the himem.sys and emm386.exe drivers. Because Windows will only load himem.sys by default, and loadlin can't start. Well, it can only start in 2 cases. It can start if neither of those drivers are loaded, or if both of them are loaded. Now, I've already got my system set up to load both himem and emm386. So I'm going to go ahead and restart in DOS mode, and then from there start Linux.
And just like any good exciting radio serial, we will stop it there and keep you in suspense until next week, when we will actually finally hear Linux and learn how to move around in Linux and do certain other functions in Linux. Thanks to Matt Campbell for his excellent weekly look at Linux.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
That concludes this edition of Main Menu, our weekly look at technology with a blindness emphasis. I'm Jonathan Mosen, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Main Menu on ACB Radio Mainstream. Bye for now.